Morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. The city of Baltimore has established a commission to decide what to do with four Confederate monuments. I'll speak with the chair of that commission, Aaron Bryant, and Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, an African-American scholar and author. Peter Brune is an artist whose focus is often on using art to tell the stories of marginalized communities. His latest project tells a very personal story. His daughter, Elisif, died of a heroin overdose. We'll learn about how that tragedy became the inspiration for the New Day campaign. Plus, a visit to the Walters Art Museum to check out its exhibition of Islamic art. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus, and a conversation with the producers of a series that features adults reading from their middle school diaries. Guess what? Eighth grade was even worse than you remember. Get ready to cringe right after the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. They are part of the city landscape that we almost never pay attention to. Bronze figures on horseback, austere men gazing over the horizon of history, monuments in parks and on thoroughfares that reflect the particular prism through which certain generations viewed the American story. Here in Baltimore, a commission established by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake is considering what, if anything, should be done with four monuments that celebrate Confederate history. Later this month, the commission will be holding a public hearing about the fate of these monuments. And this morning, I'm joined by Aaron Bryant, a social and political historian who studies political history and visual culture. He's the chair of the commission. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead is here as well. She's a scholar of African-American history who serves on the faculty of Loyola University of Maryland. Her latest book is called Letters to My Black Sons. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hey, Tom.
So, Aaron, in June, this commission was established, and to be clear, you all are reviewing only these Confederate monuments.
We're looking at four specific monuments, and actually one of the monuments isn't necessarily a Confederate monument. That would be the Taney Monument at Mount Vernon.
Okay, so that's Roger Taney, the Supreme Court Justice who was famous for his role in the Dred Scott decision.
Right.
Tell us about the other three that you're taking a look at.
We also have the Confederate Soldiers and Sailors Monument that we're looking at, the Confederate Women's Monument. And then we have the Lee Jackson Monument.
Okay, so that's Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. That's in Wyman Park Dell near Johns Hopkins University. Our producer last week, Scott Seiss, talked to some folks in Wyman Park about that statue of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson.
Do you know what this monument is?
Yes, I do.
No,
I have no idea.
I don't know.
I honestly have never read the plaque on it or anything.
Jackson and Lee, right?
It's a Confederate General Lee monument.
Does it make you think of anything when you see it?
Maybe they belong to 18th or 19th century. That's all I can think of, maybe riding horses.
Just reminds me of the old Confederacy and what the South and North fought for to kind of create the United States and so forth.
As a monument to the dead in the Civil War, I can accept it. As memorializing these two individuals, I'm of mixed feelings.
Yeah, the Civil War.
Yeah.
Like the slavery.
Do you think something should be changed about the monument?
I think it might be moved somewhere, perhaps below the Mason-Dixon line a little further, perhaps.
No, it's just a decorative fixture among the trees.
Monuments are a reflection of our past, and I would think Robert E. Lee needs to be remembered so we never do nothing like that again.
No, not really. I think it's just part of American history. I mean, there's a lot of things in American culture that are offensive to some, not to others, but General Lee and the Confederate statues, particularly this one and others, are part of American culture.
So, Aaron Bryant, these four sculptures, you've got four possibilities, I guess, that you're considering. One is to simply do nothing. What are the other options that you're considering?
Well, deaccessioning is another option where the city would actually get rid of the monuments. And another option would be to move the sculptures. And I think those are probably the three biggest ones to consider. A fourth one would be signage. And we get a lot of feedback that folks would like to know more about the sculptures.
So the signage would sort of put them in historical historical context. This is Stonewall Jackson. This is Robert E. Lee. This is what they did.
Also, just thinking curatorially, how do people make meaning and make sense out of the monuments? Why were they created? And what do they actually symbolize? What did they symbolize at the time that they were created? And what might they mean to us today?
And Dr. Kay, Kay Wise Whitehead, a discussion of these monuments is in a very real way a sort of stand-in, or at the very least a part of a larger conversation about race. How does the discussion about these particular monuments, which are part of the city's daily life, move that conversation forward?
I think what's interesting is that we are at a moment in time where we're starting to think back about everything. We're starting to assess whether or not the monuments we have, the ways in which we're living out our experience, the communities that we live in, does this particular plan we have in motion, is it working? And part of that is trying to figure out the ways in which people are reading the city. Because if you live in Baltimore City, you're passing these monuments all the time. You're not thinking about them. It's like when you live in Washington, D.C. and you pass by the monument. It's just something that you do. You don't think about it. It's the ways in which people outside of Baltimore are reading the city. And perhaps by addressing these monuments, we think that we're getting to a discussion about race. A discussion about race needs to be about the ways in which we deal with race in the city. The monuments are on the periphery. The monuments, to me, sometimes become a distraction. So we change the name of the monument. We remove them. We add signage. But is that really getting to the heart of what the problem is in Baltimore City?
And Aaron Bryant, is it easier to talk about the monuments than it is to talk about race? Are we replacing one conversation for the other?
Yeah, that's very much a possibility. I mean, right now the commission is looking specifically at the monuments because it has been brought to the City Hall's attention. Part of our recommendations, I think, would, you know, the possibility of including a larger conversation so that we can really get to what's at the heart of some of these debates.
Yeah, because, for example, this monument of Jackson and Lee was erected in 1948. 80-some years after the Civil War. The Confederacy was long gone by then. You know, the proliferation of such monuments in the mid-20th century was, in the minds of many people, a reaction to the burgeoning civil rights movement.
Also, I would say that the monument was actually paid for by someone who left the money in his will to build a monument specifically to his heroes, who were Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee. So that had something to do with it. And also, because of where we were in the context of World War II and the materials that would be used to not only build this kind of monument, but even if it started before the war, to finish it, that would have impact as well.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Aaron Bryant heads of the commission studying the Confederate monuments here in Baltimore. Kay Wise Whitehead joins me as well. She's on the faculty of Loyola University of Maryland. So, Kay, if any of these are deaccessioned, if they're just gotten rid of, thrown away, does that limit the conversation then? Is that a bad thing? I mean, are we missing an opportunity not having them up there and not having signage that would put them in context?
I think we are. As a historian who focuses on African-American history, I am concerned about the whitewashing of history. You remove the statues, you remove that point of contention, you remove that possible conversation that could potentially happen down the road. I mean, if I think 50 years out, we take away everything, the vestiges of slavery and oppression in this country, and we whitewash it, we change the name, we hide them in a museum somewhere, we are losing that moment when we can have these discussions in the future. I am not one for hiding history. I am not one for removing history. Keep it there. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about ways we can reclaim that space. I am someone who believes in signage. Add some contextualization. Let people know this is where they were in 1948, and we are no longer there. And there's a reason that we're not.
And Aaron Bryant, what about the argument that says, look, this is art. It's public art.
Well, I think that's part of what I find exciting about the debate, actually, is that you have so many different perspectives. And as Kay was talking about earlier, this whole notion of we need to create some sort of civic discourse so that we can actually talk about the issues and how material culture has public and private meaning for individuals. And part of that conversation would be, how do we contextualize race in terms of meaning, both public and private? But in terms of the art historical impact, I think that some of these monuments have, or significance that these monuments might have, something like the Jackson Lee Monument is actually a fairly decent example of a double equestrian, which is unusual in art history. So they do have art history.
In other words, this is the first example of a statue that had two guys on horses instead of one guy on horses.
Right. One of the first examples, because it's very difficult to create as a sculptor. And it was also, I believe the sculpture was created by a woman. So that also has has art historical significance as well. And then you look at it in the context of World War II, and then these other layers of race and class.
And Dr. Kay, what would we say, for example, about the statues of Roger Taney? There's a controversy about having the statue of Taney in front of the Annapolis State House. The one in Baltimore is a copy of that one.
Right.
There's a similar controversy about a Taney statue in Frederick. When you talk about signage, when you talk about contextualization, here's the guy who oversaw the passage of the Dred Scott decision. Which
people don't know about.
Yeah.
People don't know about Dred Scott. It's the same that we heard in this clip. People are unfamiliar with the history. They walk by it. And I think that by putting a Band-Aid over it, by just removing it, we are removing the potential to really have a deeper discussion, not just about what it means in terms of race, but where Taney fits in history. Like, understanding Dred Scott, understanding Plessy v. Ferguson helps you to understand Brown v. Boer. And I would argue it helps you to understand Black Lives Matter, that there is this continuum of African-American history within the American historical blanket that we need to talk about. So we remove the Confederate flag in South Carolina. I mean, I'm from South Carolina. I was involved in that discussion about removing the flags. But removing the flag from the State House does not remove it from the hearts and minds of people who live in South Carolina. And that's what the conversation is about. Not the Confederate flag as this symbol, but what does it mean for people and how do they play out what this symbol means in the ways in which they deal with people of color in South Carolina. So then you deal with Yale, you deal with Brown, you deal with trying to find a way to put a Band-Aid over a real serious, deep-rooted wound in our culture. And that wound is around the ways in which we understand, play out, model, and begin to teach our children about the ways in which people have equality and are oppressed in this country.
And Aaron Bryan, a solution that a lot of folks in South Carolina think is the proper solution is to put that flag in a museum and have the signage and the context and all that stuff rather than in the public sphere. Is that an option for these monuments? It's one thing to have this interesting example of art by a woman and a double equestrian, but why have it in Wyman Park? Let's put it in the Walters Art Museum or the Baltimore Museum of Art.
Well, I think that sort of decontextualizes this actual history, because then we begin to whitewash that it was here and it was in public, and then all people, including Black people, had to walk by it every day. And what it meant is that a form of cultural violence, for example. Mm-hmm. And so we missed the opportunity to talk about what it was like to be Black in 1948, to have to walk past the statue. And so it absolves people of any shame or guilt or culpability and all of this. So I think we can have those really kind of dynamic sorts of conversations. I would also say that the monuments are different to me. I have to think about this than the Confederate flag, because there are also issues of constitutionality. Some people might argue, and it's a valid point, I think all points are valid. If you put up the Confederate flag, you should also put up the Black Panther flag or Black Lives Matter flag. And if you can't have the state represent all of these different points of views within its public space, then you represent no point of view. You have to remain neutral.
I appreciate both of you coming by and adding a great perspective this morning. Thanks so much. Aaron Bryan chairs the Commission to Review Baltimore's Confederate Monuments. He's the Andrew Mellon Curator of Photography at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which is expected to open its doors next year in Washington. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead is an Associate Professor of Communication and African and African American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland and the author of Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. The public forum to discuss the Confederate monuments will be held a week from Tuesday, December 15th, from 5 to 8 at Baltimore City Hall. We'll have a link to information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We turn now to the artist Peter Brune. His latest work emerged after a terrible tragedy in his family when their 24-year-old daughter, Elisif, died of a heroin overdose in February of 2014. Peter has developed a project called the New Day Campaign, which uses art to address the stigma surrounding addiction. campaign began in October. It includes 16 art exhibitions and 63 public events, several of which are happening over the next few days. One of the exhibitions is at Stevenson University. It's a multi-prong installation by Peter Bruhn that includes visual art, sound, and light, entitled Elisif's Story. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
And as I told you at the time that Elisif passed away, our sincere condolences to you and your family. It's been a terrible time for you, hasn't it?
It's been quite a ride the past almost 2 years, yeah.
Heroin addiction is on the rise nationwide, and here in Maryland, it was an issue in the gubernatorial campaign. Governor Hogan brought it to the fore of his campaign and has continued to concentrate on it. We think of, or used to think of, heroin addiction as something that was endemic in urban communities, the Wire, the Corner, that kind of thing. But of course, it is statewide here in Maryland, and nationally, it's in rural areas, suburban areas. Your daughter grew up in a loving home. She did not have any of the problems that many people in urban environments face who are also facing addiction. She didn't have food insecurity. She didn't have housing insecurity. She was loved and, comforted and paid attention to by you and your wife and your whole family. What were your aspirations for this particular project that's been inspired by her passing?
I think the most significant thing that inspired the New Day campaign is when Elisif died, what I abhorred was the thought of judgment and viewing Elisif as weak and immoral, because addiction arises not out of weakness and immorality, but a whole complex of things that has nothing to do with character. So I wanted to challenge that notion and humanize those who face not just addiction, but mental illness as well.
So your exhibition at Stevenson called Elisif's Story includes 24 paintings that you did, one for every year of Elisif's life. It also includes an audio track of various people talking about Elisif. Here's a clip of her grandmother, her maternal grandmother, your wife's mom, Susan Auchincloss, talking about Elisif Bruhn.
I think that where she could have made good choices and didn't, it wasn't that she was making bad choices. It was that she didn't feel that she had a choice. There just seemed to be one avenue that was really open to her, and that's the one she took.
That's Susan Auchincloss speaking about her granddaughter, Elisif Bruhn, who died from a heroin overdose in 2014. Dr. Robert Bruner joins us on the phone from his home in Clarksville. He's the director of addiction treatment services at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center and an expert on substance use disorder. Dr. Bruner, welcome to the program. Tell us, this notion of choice when it comes to substance abuse and substance use disorder, how does it play into that condition?
Well, people often question whether choice is a relevant variable or even concept in people who suffer from substance use disorder. And my best answer to it is yes, people make choices both before they develop substance use disorder and they make choices after the onset of substance use disorder. The problem is the disorder changes both inside their brain and body and changes their outside, their environment, in ways that it seems hard to understand or predict. And the relevant aspect here is that not all possibilities are equally reinforcing to people. Some of the options have more reinforcing value than others, and one of the things we work on with our patients is what their current reinforcers are and what we can do to change the reinforcers so that we can get them to behave in ways that, frankly, are better for them and certainly better for everyone around them. There's a whole field called behavioral economics that helps us understand this choice process. And one of the big terms is something called delayed discounting. And the basic principle is the farther out in time the reinforcer is from the point of action, the less reinforcing value it has. So if I offered somebody $100 today or $100 a month from now and gave them a choice, virtually 99.9% of people I offered these choices to would pick the $100 today. However, if I offered them $100 today versus $1,000 in a month, most would in fact pick the $1,000 in a month. Most would. One group that would likely pick the $100 still are people who suffer from substance use disorder, because the disorder affects parts of the brain where emotion and reward in decision making is regulated.
So, Peter Bruhn, you're having an event on Saturday, and there's this long list of artists and authors. I mean, it's almost like a dozen people or something who are going to contemplate these issues in an event. This is a medical condition. It's a disorder. It's a public health crisis. In 2014, more people died in the city of Baltimore from heroin overdose than died from homicide. And Dr. Lena Nguyen of the public health, the public health commissioner here, is addressing it in various ways. If this is a medical issue, if it's a public health issue, what do artists have to say about this, and why should we take what you have to say about it and your other colleagues in this endeavor? Why should we be paying attention to that?
Sure, because as Dr. Bruhner points out, those with substance use disorder make choices both before having a substance use disorder as well as when they do. And I think we all exist in a spectrum of choice, and we all exist in a spectrum of addictive tendencies and abilities to think through these issues. And folks are on the spectrum.
Artists included.
Absolutely. Yeah. And these are artists who have thought deeply about this particular issue because of their own lived experience.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the time we have today, but I appreciate both of your insights into this very, very difficult problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The artist Peter Bruhn is the founder and director of the New Day Campaign. Dr. Robert Bruhner is the director of addiction treatment services at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. The New Day Campaign includes events in 8 different series related to the subject of addiction. For example, tonight at 7 o'clock, Peter Bruhn and Sharon Strauss, another parent who has lost a child to addiction, will speak at the McDonough School in Baltimore County. And on Saturday, Peter, Dr. Bruhner, and several others will be part of an event called Mental Illness, Addiction, and Choice, an Exploration. It will be held at Stevenson University from 1 to 5:30 Saturday afternoon. There are many, many more related events scheduled throughout the rest of this month. We've got a link to all of the New Day campaign events on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. I have recently come across some old VHS tapes of some television appearances I did in the early 1980s. When I looked at them, I was reminded that the 1980s were a long, long time ago. Much of it, well, actually all of it, is stunningly cringeworthy. And I was in my 20s at the time, and I'm assuming that as a teenager, had there been much tape available from that period of my life, and thankfully there isn't, I would have found that tape to be even more cringeworthy. But if you're one of the organizers of a Mortified event, it turns out that cringeworthiness is valued above all else. Mortified events take place all over the country, and there's one coming up this week here in Baltimore. At these events, adults read from their childhood diaries in front of a live audience. And I've got two organizers of the Baltimore event with me this morning. Alex Hewitt joins me in the studio, and Adam Ruman joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi, thank you.
So, Alex, how does this work? How do you find people that are brave enough to read from their, like, middle school diaries?
Well, people come to the show, and they either decide, oh, my God, I want to do this, or I could never do this. And if you're interested, you can go online to Get Mortified and click on participate, and you fill in the information, and one of the story producers will contact you.
So you have to audition?
Well,
sort of.
everyone, you will say that you're interested in it, so you will submit your information, and then you come to a screening session, and you bring everything. People bring boxes and bags of all their stuff that they found at their parents' house, and we go through your poetry, your stories, your school papers. The story producers help curate a story for you, but 90% of it is, you know, reading directly from your archives of your youth.
So, Adam, these are unedited, these are unexpurgated, this is the real deal from people's 6th grade, 8th grade time.
Well, they're the real deal. They are slightly edited in the sense that if you stood up there and read your entire diary cover to cover, the show will be 9 hours long. but we do help you sort of go through and pick out the best parts, the most cringeworthy parts, the parts where you're talking about how you weren't able to get your crush to look at you at the Belle of DeVoe concert or something like that. But yeah, every single word read from these on stage or shown on a video, everything is 100% authentic. It's just that sometimes we do have to cut out the 4 months where you just talked about what you ate for breakfast every day.
So, Alex, you've actually brought your diary from what age were you?
1983. I was 14.
Can you read us a little clip?
Sure. Sunday, March 20th, 1983. David and I went to Midstate. We went bowling. I bowled a 20, 21, and a 40. David did much better than I. After we bowled, we were by the video games. I was doing pretty good at Miss Pac-Man. After that, this part is censored, I wish, we went off to a private place, a room where there are lockers and stuff, a room in which we were alone together, a togetherness I cannot capture in words, but I'll try. We Frenched for about 10 to 15 minutes, not continuous, but we were going strong for a while. This was my first time Frenching, but I did okay, and so did David. By the summer of 1983, I wanted more than French kissing. I wanted romance and magic.
Well, Alex, I'm glad that you were better at Frenching than you were at bowling.
I know.
You bowled
my
a 20
God.
In one of those games?
I know.
Gosh, that alone is cringeworthy.
Right, exactly.
So, Adam, I mean, these stories, everybody in the audience shares the notion that, you know, oh my gosh, that could have been me or that was me, right? I mean, I suppose there's like a community, it seems, has grown up around this notion of sharing what things were like when you were in your early teens.
Yeah, I think a lot of people listen to these things and they remember their own experiences, which is so strange because at the time when you were in high school or in junior high school, you think you're the only one going through this. And it's really only from doing Mortified that I've realized, no, it was really, you know, we weren't in a minority feeling awkward. We were in the majority. Everybody felt awkward, and nobody felt comfortable enough to talk about it. And it's great to be a full-fledged adult feeling comfortable enough with yourself to celebrate that sort of awkwardness.
Here's one of the fellows that appeared at one of the recent Mortified Baltimores, a guy named Thomas King, talking about a young lady he's quite infatuated with.
I love it when I see your Saturn in the parking lot. It makes me happy. But above everything, I love your laugh. Your laugh fills me with joy and happiness, and it is high and pure, and it makes anything seem possible. When I'm in the library during second period, and you and Troll come in out to get out of Spanish, and you sit with us, and I read these poems in the Adam Sandler voice, and you laugh, I can't stand it. I want everyone to laugh, sure, but I'm really doing it for you.
Ah, the helpless romantic. All right, well, Alex Hewitt, good luck. You're going to be reading at this one coming up Saturday?
No, I'm not. I will be in the audience supporting our storytellers. I've done twice. seven times. Yes,
good
I've
for you. It, yeah. And Adam, how about you? Will we hear any of your cringeworthy moments from junior high school, or are you going to take this night off?
I'm not taking the night off. I'm going to be producing the show. And I'll be there running the projector and sound and things like that, but I'm not going to be reading this time. We've got 6 brand new performers, and they're all going to be terrific.
All right, well, it sounds like a hoot. Thanks for joining us, Alex Hewitt and Adam Rubin. The next Mortified Baltimore happens Saturday night at Gallery 788 on Hickory Avenue in Hamden. It starts at 8, doors open at 7. Get there early if you don't want to stand. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, On with the show.
Maryland Morning, I'm Tom Hall. A couple days ago, I went to the Walters Art Museum here in Baltimore to see its new exhibition of Islamic art. It's called Pearls on a String, and I spoke with the Associate Curator of Islamic and South Asian Art, Amy Landau.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you again as well.
So Pearls on a String, there are some, there's a lot of jewels in this show, actually, but the pearls in this instance doesn't necessarily refer to jewels in the regular sense. This is a metaphor, and this is a metaphor that's deeply embedded in Islamic culture.
Yes, that's right. Pearls on a String, Reshteye Gohar, is a metaphor that appears in Persian, Arabic, and Turkish poetry. And it generally refers to particulars within collections, so individuals within communities. This metaphor inspired the show, which has three sections, and each of these sections refers to one pearl, spins around one individual, and explores how his ambition was actualized in a community of other individuals.
And each of these individuals comes from different periods in time. We're standing in front of an incredible manuscript here by a writer named Abul Fazl. He is a 16th century figure. Describe what we're looking at, this beautiful book.
We're looking at one of the most beautiful illustrated and illuminated copies of Abul Fazl's history, which is known as the Akbarnameh. This is a history that was written in Persian, and it captures the essence of a court community active in the 16th century in northern India. And Abul Fazl writes about how this community wanted to betray themselves, that they were a group who were deeply engaged with other intellectual, philosophical, aesthetic traditions, brings to life interactions between Muslim communities and the Hindu and Jain communities living in South Asia, as well as the recently embedded Christian communities that are there as a result of Latin missionaries being sent throughout Asia.
So this is a beautiful manuscript. There are more than 120 objects, I guess, and paintings and whatnot in this exhibition. About a third of them come from the collection here at the Walters, and then you have some very special things that are on loan from places. But next to this beautiful manuscript of Abul Fazl, we have these three beautiful paintings, and they happen concurrently with Mr. Fazl writing his history.
Exactly. Abul Fazl's words were so powerful and respected so much that as he was writing his history from around the late 1580s to his death in 1602, artists were immediately transforming his words into visual expressions. And here we see how Abul Fazl was part of both momentous and private moments at the court. So looking at the painting, the first one we encounter is Abul Fazl presenting his second volume of the Akbarnameh to his patron, Emperor Akbar. And you see the crowds gathered around in anticipation. While many people at court viewed this history as one of the most important texts of its time, Abul Fazl, because of his character, his nature, he had a very passionate sense of right and wrong. His character actually earned him foes as well. So while many people celebrated his text, there were others who were uncomfortable with certain portrayals he had of the emperor, mainly that his patron, Emperor Akbar, was divine in status, so had spiritual and temporal power.
What's your take as a scholar, as a person who knows so much about this, in terms of the veracity, the trustworthiness
Yes.
of these histories and these objects to give us a light into what's going on at the time?
Abul Fazl focuses quite a bit on the veracity of his sources in writing this history. He brings this up repeatedly in his three-volume history, and he says he emphasized both archival research as well as interviews. And this makes Abul Fazl's history have this very contemporary tone in that he was actually interviewing those who surrounded him at court for their recollections. And it was not only the Muslim and Hindu officials at court, he also laid emphasis on getting the memories of the women of the harem. And here we have a beautiful image of Akbar's mother coming from Kabul to northern India to visit her son Akbar, accompanied by female relatives. One of them, Golbadan, who we see in the lower left-hand corner, left her memoir of Akbar's predecessors. So Abul Fazl relied on women of the court for their recounts of the past. And this is what differentiates Akbar's history in many ways from previous accounts.
So we have a writer. We also have a section here in this incredible exhibit. It's just, first of all, it's huge. There's so many different objects and different paintings and different pieces of sculpture, etc. But we also have a painter. This is Mohammed Zaman, and we're standing in front of a very surprising picture, to me at least, because here's a Muslim artist writing, or working rather, in the 17th century, and it's a picture of the Holy Family on the return from the flight into Egypt. This is Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, fully equipped with halos, walking across as they come back from the flight into Egypt. This is kind of a surprise.
Yes, whereas Abul Fazl captures a moment of time through the written word, Mohammed Zaman captures his moment, 17th century Safavid Iran, through the image. And here we have one of a series of images of pre-Islamic biblical prophets that Mohammed Zaman executed for the Muslim political elite. And to create these images, he relied heavily on both European prints and European oils that are coming into Iran through diplomatic channels, through economic channels. And what defines Mohammed Zaman's period is that here we have, in the 17th century, affluent resident Christian communities. We have the Armenian merchants, and we also have the Latin missionaries. And they are building churches during Mohammed Zaman's lifetime that are covered really from floor to ceiling with images of the pre-Islamic prophets. And the Muslim community, they weren't looking at these images as something just novel, something foreign. They're recognizing images such as Joseph, Mary, and Jesus through their own literary traditions, such as the Quran, for example, such as a whole genre dedicated to stories of the pre-Islamic prophets called Qisas al-Anbiya. And Mohammed Zaman is very aware and sensitive to the fact that Muslims do not decorate their places of worship or their holy text, the Quran, with images of the prophets. But his patrons were engaged, and we have many recollections of Muslim rulers being engaged with Christian iconography. So he knows that difference. So he creates these wonderful images in the acceptable format of a single-page painting, which people can enjoy at their leisure in their homes, in their palaces.
I want to walk by this incredible gun of all things. It's a long gun, a long rifle, and it is covered in gold and bespeckled with more jewels than you can shake a stick at. And in addition to the gun itself, this long gun, there are all these things that fit into it. This is commissioned by a patron whose work was during the 18th century. His name is Mahmoud. Describe for us this incredible long gun that we're looking as we finish up.
So we have a wonderful long gun with thousands of diamonds, emeralds, and rubies. And what differentiates this commission is that it has a dagger and a writing implement set that ingeniously fit into the stock of the rifle. This object speaks very much to Mahmoud's ambitions as a patron, his interest in novelty, and in clever engineering of wonderful works of art. What's also interesting about Mahmoud is that because he was born with an abnormal curvature of the spine, he himself was not actually a good shot. This is a ceremonial object. There's no evidence that it was actually ever even shot. It was to be part of the royal regalia of Mahmoud living in 18th century Istanbul.
Amy Landau is the Associate Curator of Islamic and South Asian Art at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore. We spoke earlier this week. The exhibition is called Pearls on a String, Artists, Patrons, and Poets at the Great Islamic Courts. It's at the Walters until the end of next month. On Sunday, there's a walk-in tour of the show, and then at 2 o'clock, there's a panel discussion on the Muslim experience in Baltimore. For more information, come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.